Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, December 10th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the Harris case, argued Tuesday in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome a new guest to Teleforum, Mark F. Hearn II. He's a partner at Arent Fox. He goes by Thor Hearn. He's going to open with 5 to 10 minutes of remarks. He actually argued the case on Tuesday, so we've got special insight today for our audience. After his 5 to 10 minutes of opening remarks, as always, we're going to take questions from the audience, so please do be thinking of your questions as we move forward in the program. With that, Thor Hearn, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dean, and it's great to be here with you all today. As you know, this week, which is the topic of this call, we had argument on Tuesday morning in two significant redistricting cases, the first of which was the Harris versus Arizona Redistricting Commission, which I argued, and then following that was the Evanwell case involving Texas. We're going to talk about the Harris case today, but before I talk specifically about the Harris case, let me set the table a little bit by providing some sense of the context in which this case arises. And I would say there's basically three concepts that inform both the argument and what we believe will ultimately be the decision in the case. Those three concepts are partisanship, preclearance, and proof. So partisanship refers to the degree to which partisanship can influence, to what extent is it permissible, influencing the reapportionment of a state legislature. And I'll come back to that in a second. The second point has to do with the preclearance, which was, in our case, used as a justification for deviating from the constitutional principle of one person, one vote. And then finally, there's going to be the question of what degree of proof, what's the standard of proof or the burden of proof that a party must establish if they're going to successfully challenge a malapportioned reapportionment scheme for a specific state legislature. So those are the three points that I think frame the argument. I'll talk first, before getting into our case, about the prior case, because if those who have had a chance to read the transcript, or if you later look at the or listen to the audio of the argument, it's difficult to fully appreciate the interaction between the justices and the justices and counsel without also understanding the context of the prior case. So the prior case was the Arizona Legislature versus Arizona Redistricting Commission. The history is this. The state of Arizona, through a citizens' initiative petition, amended their constitution to remove redistricting or reapportionment, both congressional as well as Arizona State House and Senate, from the legislature. And they removed the responsibility or even any role at all from the legislative or elective process more than any other state. The commission was really rather dramatic. What it is a commission that is appointed by another commission. So you have another commission puts forward two lists, one supposedly Republican, one supposedly Democrat. They have a list of 10 people on each, and then the leaders of the House and Senate choose from those two supposedly Republican members and two supposedly Democrat members. Out of those four members, then choose from another list that is also put forward by this also, quote, independent commission, a, quote, independent chairman who will is a independent, meaning not registered as a Republican or a Democrat. That's the context of the commission. The way the commission this time actually worked is the fifth person they picked was a highly partisan activist. It betrayed the ideal that the entire process was set up to achieve, which was to remove partisanship from redistricting, either congressional or state legislative. So what happened next? Here's what happened. The commission met. While the commission was commencing their work, it became very clear to everyone that it was becoming very partisan, not doing what was intended. The Arizona legislature and governor, with two-thirds vote in the Senate, sought to remove the chairman from the commission because she was failing in her duties and it was so partisan. Nonetheless, the Arizona Supreme Court overturned that and said that the state legislature and Governor Brewer did not have the ability to remove the chairman from the commission, so they validated the commission's authority and let the commission proceed. The commission then devised two different districting schemes, one for the congressional races, one for the state house. I'll talk about each very quickly. The congressional district, they had another congressional district, so they apportioned those districts. Now, in the congressional districts, they did so equally, apportioning the population equally into each congressional district. Congressional districts are apportioned by state legislatures under the Election Clause, Article 1, Section 4, which says the state, quote, legislature shall apportion each state's districts for electing congressional representatives. Congress has an overriding ability to, if you will, adjust that. That doesn't come into play. The issue in the first case, which Paul Clement argued and argued very well, was whether or not the word legislature does or doesn't include a five-member independent commission that has no accountability to any legislative body and is essentially entirely unaccountable to the political process. Paul Clement argued for the Arizona State Legislature that no, of course, that is not what the Constitution meant. When Congress said that the state shall be apportioned by the legislature, they meant the elected legislature, not some independent commission that was unaccountable. That decision came out in June. In June, the majority written by Ginsburg said that the word legislature would include a independent commission such as this. That decision was written over a rather scathing dissent authored by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Scalia, Alito, and Thomas. Thomas and Scalia, both separately and additionally wrote separate dissents. It was a pretty contentious dissent. Scalia particularly noted the point that there's no rational way to conclude that the word capital L legislature used in the Constitution ever intended to mean an unelected commission such as this. But be that as it may, that was the decision. So you have a 5-4 decision validating the constitutional authority of the commission to, in fact, apportion Arizona's congressional districts. And that was the end of that case. At the same day that the court announced their decision in that case, the court announced that they would take this case. So this case is the same commission doing the same thing, apportioning Arizona's legislature, but in this case, it's the Arizona State Legislature. Traditionally, the court has afforded greater discretion for principals, those, you know, who share federalism principles and concerns for state sovereignty would recognize. Have recognized the deference a federal court should afford a state when a state is engaged in the sovereign function of apportioning its own state legislature. So whereas in prior decisions the court has had a more strict requirement of one person, one vote when congressional districts are drawn, it tends to defer a little more to states when state legislative districts are drawn. But traditionally, the only deference has been afforded for things such as a county boundaries, preserving a single county in the same legislative district. There's never been a decision by the court affording an excuse to deviate from one person, one vote for any reason, such as partisanship, or to comply with some bad advice about what the Voting Rights Act requires. And I'll come to that in just a second. So that was the case we framed. The lower court, which was a three-judge district court, had a trial. They looked into how it was that the commission came up with these districts. The trial found that the commission, this five-member Democrat-dominated, as it turned out, and was very clearly so, commission, and it doesn't really matter, frankly, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. The point that was prevailing was that it was a partisan objective, that this commission malapportioned the Arizona legislature with deviations of up to 8.8% from the ideal one person, one vote. In other words, they diluted the votes of 3.9 million Arizona citizens and overweighted the votes of 2.5 million Arizona citizens to achieve a specific objective. And that specific objective, actually two specific objectives, were number one, to gain a partisan advantage for the Democrat Party, and number two, to what they claimed was achieve preclearance under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, this whole preclearance pretext becomes more interesting because of the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County. Shelby County, of course, the Supreme Court struck down the Section 4B formula by which Arizona and other jurisdictions were covered under the Section 5 preclearance. I'm assuming everybody's familiar with that, but I'll belabor the point just a step. Section 5 is very unusual. It's very extraordinary. It's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act says we are going to require states, before they can make any change in the election device or procedure, to first submit it to either the Justice Department or to the district court in Washington, D.C., to have that procedure approved. In other words, it's a statutory injunction that intrudes rather dramatically, not rather, but very dramatically, upon state sovereignty. It says the federal government now trumps any state election procedure, and none of those are valid until you get our permission. It's a mother may I in terms of federalism. So that is a substantial intrusion into traditional principles of federalism and state sovereignty. Notwithstanding, because of the racial situation in the 1960s and following really the implementation of that and the Voting Rights Act, the court has tolerated that, but they've always recognized it's exceptional. So in Shelby County, the court, again, in a 5-4 decision with the majority, which included Kennedy, in a decision written by Justice Roberts, it said this formula is no longer rational because it's including states that don't have a rational relation to a legitimate, overwhelming objective of the federal government sufficient to intrude into these principles of state sovereignty and federalism. The decision in Shelby County concerned Shelby County, Alabama. That decision was particularly apropos to Arizona because the history in Arizona was never subject to the Voting Rights Act until 1975. In 1975, when Congress reauthorized it, it became subject to it, really by a quirk, because Arizona in 1901 it had a literacy test, but that literacy test was repealed in 1972. And in fact, Arizona had bilingual ballots. So there's no legitimate reason for Arizona to have been included in the Voting Rights Act coverage, yet it was under the formula that Congress wrote. So that's a particularly rich irony that sort of colors the background of this case. So all of that said, in this case, the commission said we have, and the district court below found a majority of all three of the members agreed on this. This commission was driven by an objective to achieve a partisan advantage for the Democratic Party, number one. And then number two, this commission had the mistaken belief that they needed to malapportion, in other words, underpopulate certain Hispanic districts, 10 Hispanic districts, in order to gain preclearance approval from the Justice Department. Now, why did they believe that? They believe that because they hired a Democrat consultant who told them that. So the question in part in this case becomes, does bad legal advice from a Democrat consultant excuse or immunize a commission from malapportioning 3.9 million Arizona voters' votes, in other words, diluting their votes? We would say no. That was the issue. Those were the two issues the Supreme Court took, and that was the context in which the argument was made. When I began, I said there were three points that tended to inform this case, the first being partisanship, the second being preclearance, and the third being proof. So as to partisanship and preclearance, again, the two justifications were, does partisanship ever allow a redistricting authority to deviate from the constitutional principle of one person, one vote? We argue no. The court below, all three judges, assumed that it was an illegitimate purpose. So you have an illegitimate purpose for the malapportioned legislature. Then the question shifts to, well, does the fact that their advisor, a fellow named Bruce Adelson, told them wrongly, bad legal advice, that doing this was necessary to obtain preclearance? We have two responses to that. The first is, you can't have a unequally populated districts on that belief, because the Voting Rights Act itself is a statute. A statute cannot command or compel a violation of the U.S. Constitution, the one person, one vote principle. So his advice was entirely wrong. The fact that two members or three members of the commission had a, quote, good faith belief that what he was telling them was accurate does not exonerate them from that. And that's a clear point in the Supreme Court's Shaw series of cases, that bad legal advice doesn't excuse a malapportioned or racially malapportioned district. So that was our response on that point. But one of the fundamental features, and it was a point that we developed much more during our preparation for oral argument, and I'm greatly indebted to Mike Carvin for all of his comments on this point, which really helped us sharpen the point, was the fact that it's the burden of proof. And so there's a series of famous cases in other contexts called Mount Healthy in Arlington Heights. What they say is that when you have a mixed motive case, which everyone admits this is a mixed motive. So there's two motives. Motive one is, we did this to help the Democrats, that's illegitimate. Mixed motive two, we did it because we had to obtain preclearance. We dispute that motive, but assuming it's legitimate, we now have two motives, one purportedly legitimate, one illegitimate. When you have mixed motives as a justification to violate a constitutional right or a fundamental right, what you then look at is a burden shift. So that point was brought up particularly by Justice Alito, who specifically referenced Mount Healthy. And the obligation that once we'd established, which we being the voters in Arizona, had established that the commission had one illegitimate motive benefiting the Democrats for what they did, at that point then the burden shifted to the commission to prove that the illegitimate motive was not in fact why they did it, but in fact it was the quote legitimate motive of preclearance. That was discussed between Justice Alito and, again, I think Justice Kagan also, as I recall, brought that up, referencing the Bush v. Vera case, where the question that she had is, well, shouldn't the evidential or burden of proof standard require the plaintiff to not only show that there was an illegitimate motive, but also to show that the illegitimate motive predominated. So that is a final factor that will be considered in the course of this decision. That's what I'm referring to in the third criteria of proof as a theme that will emerge from this case. The comments between the various justices as the case was argued tended very much, particularly Justice Scalia versus Justice Breyer, to reflect the justices' decision in last term's decision of the Arizona legislature versus the commission. Justice Scalia specifically said, well, isn't it interesting? I just wish we'd had this case before we had the last case. Maybe we could have gotten that one right, or something to very close to that effect. Justice Ginsburg, the author of that decision, sought to defend because let me step back a half step. I mean, on a policy matter, the four liberals like this notion of independent, nonpartisan redistricting commissions. They think that's wonderful. I mean, it sort of works with NPR. I mean, it sounds so above the fray. If we could only have redistricting done by politically unaccountable, what Justice Scalia called, quote, divine commissions that are removed from the hurly-burly of politics, we would have much fairer districting. That was not a position, certainly, that's shared by what I'd call the realist faction in the court. And then the one person sort of swinging back and forth between the two is, not surprisingly, Justice Kennedy, who, as he looks at it, doesn't like partisanship, because you read his opinion in some cases such as Veith, where he separately concurred. He doesn't like the notion of partisanship, but he also recognizes the realistic impossibility of the court trying to ferret out partisanship from the political redistricting process. So what you have is, again, your sort of typical 4-4 with Kennedy in the middle on that issue. But the other issue that's running at cross currents to that is this issue of sovereignty and state federalism principles. So why should we have federal courts intruding in the state as they exercise one of the quintessential state sovereign functions of apportioning their own legislature? So in that sense, particularly going into the oral argument, I was concerned that Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, and to a lesser degree Robertson Alito would be very sensitive to that concern, as I am personally as well. The concern says we don't want to open the door for federal courts to get in at minor deviations and second-guess every little decision some state makes. Two responses that I propose to that. One is, well, first off, this wasn't the state of Arizona legislature doing this redistricting. That was obvious from the fact that the Attorney General of Arizona was on my side sitting at the council table, also supporting our position, as was the Secretary of State and the legislature of Arizona and the governor of Arizona, all opposed what the commission did. So you cannot say that it was actually a Arizona legislature that was engaged in this. So there's not that same level of deference. Now, that speaks to Justice Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito's concern. But beyond that, the issue that Justice Ginsburg wanted to do was to try to defend the, quote, nonpartisanship of the commission. And she said, well, they didn't do a very good job, did they? Because after they were done with their reapportionment, we did have an election, and in that election, the Republicans still control the majority of the Arizona House and Senate. So if you think this was a political gerrymander, it was a very ineffective one. My response to that was to note that an incompetent gerrymander is no less a gerrymander when you're diluting the votes of a significant, in this case, 3.9 million Arizona voters or Arizona people, another issue to discuss in the context of Evenwell. You are nonetheless violating the court's one person, one vote principle. So that's the context of the case. That's from the context that colored the arguments. And I would say, in conclusion to my introductory remarks, that this is a case that does provide the court an opportunity, given each individual's unique, each individual justice's unique perspective, to go back and really integrate the original Baker v. Carr from 1962 and the 1964 reapportionment decisions, including, you know, Reynolds and Westbury and the others, and try to come forward with a coherent principle that provides a clear justiciable standard for states when they reapportion state legislatures. What I actually think they'll probably do is look at this case, and the easy way out is to look at what Justice Alito was referring to, which was the Mount Healthy evidence burden standard, A likely or potential outcome would be that it's remanded to the district court with directions to evaluate the commission's defense of their malapportionment and require the burden shift to them since we have established an illegitimate motive, and now let them come forward with some excuse or some justification for their excuse that in fact it was malapportioned because they had to do so to comply with the preclearance requirements. And that would be a position that I don't believe the commission could succeed in maintaining. So I went a little longer than I originally planned, but that's my summary of where I think we are, what to expect as the case moves forward. And certainly any questions, Dean, or anything anybody has.
Thank you so much. Let's open it up right away to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we wait to see if somebody rings in, let me talk about the upcoming schedule. Tomorrow, our teleforum will concern a new book by New York Times journalist David Savage, who will be joined by Paul Rosenzweig. They'll be taking an insider's look at the war on terror, something that's extremely topical. But today, of course, we're talking to Mark Thor Hearn. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me get us started, if I could. You mentioned the possibility of second-guessing by some justices about federal court meddling, I guess, in state legislator business when it comes to redistricting. I'm not clear whether you... I know you feared that, or you were careful about that going in. I'm not clear on the back end of your argument whether you had sensed any of that in any justices, and whether you actually had to make your arguments to sort of directed at those concerns.
That's a good question, Dean. We went into it, and obviously, my own personal view is I'm not a fan of federal court intervention in state sovereign functions. And I know that all the conservative members of the court share that view, especially Scalia. And let me go back and maybe provide just a little bit of context to that, too. Recall that this, the whole concept of one person, one vote and reapportionment really was created in the early 1960s, primarily with 1962. In Baker v. Carr, in which you had Justice Frankfurter and Justice Harlan dissent rather vigorously. The famous phrase from Justice Frankfurter's dissent is the federal courts should not jump into the political thicket of state politics. In that case, it was a Colgrove versus Green. The point of that case was trying to reapportion districts in Illinois, which had not been reapportioned in a long period of time, were very unequal. And it tended to favor rural areas, giving them much more weight over city and urban areas. Now, at the time of that decision, Justice Stevens was in law school in Chicago. I mentioned that as an aside. I'll come back to that in a moment. So then after that, you have the 1964 series of cases, which are Reynolds and Westbury and WMAC and the others, which were seven cases, all decided, six of them on the same day, in June 1964 by the Warren Court. I mean, these cases were at the time criticized as a massive intrusion into state sovereignty because they basically created the one person, one vote rule. They required that all 50 states apportion their state legislatures as well as the congressional districts using strict one person, one vote. They did allow, obviously, for the possibility of some deviation from that, but they upset the existing understanding in terms of federalism as the responsibility or ability of a state to independently reapportion both their own state legislature as well as even their congressional districts. So in that sense, it was quite dramatic. People started putting impeach Earl Warren bumper stickers on their cars, in part because of this. I mean, this was a dramatic intrusion of the Supreme Court announcing a new rule into state sovereignty and overturning what had been understood to be principles of federalism. Justice Harlan dissented vigorously in all those cases, saying, again, carrying on the tune of Justice Frankfurter, who was then no longer on the court, that the court should not be involved in these kind of political decisions. They were non-justiciable, and these matters should be left to the state. So that's the context in which we get the one person, one vote. Now, obviously, in my entire lifetime, we've lived with that principle. The states have lived under that. We've used that as a implementing factor in both congressional as well as state legislative districts. And so when the issue came up here in Arizona, the real question is, to what degree do we want to defer to a state, or in this case it wasn't the state, it was the commission, their ability to depart from that and use their own discretion to draw these districts. And so in doing so, Justice Scalia had shown, and this goes to your question, Dean, Justice Scalia had shown a prior history of deference to the states, again, a point that, you know, those who share principles of federalism certainly are sympathetic to, allowing states to accommodate their own unique interests. Again, traditionally, it's been what they call neutral principles, such as county lines, keeping districts together. But it's never been extended to things such as achieving a partisan advantage, nor has it been extended to this concept of bad advice necessary to comply with the Voting Rights Act. So those are the unique considerations here. Nonetheless, there was in the past a quote, 10% rule. It wasn't really a rule, it was a burden-shifting statute. It came out of a plurality decision called Brown v. Thompson. And in that case, what they said was, three of the justices in a decision by Powell, joined by Berger and Rehnquist, said in the case of Wyoming, which had some malapportioned districts, in other words, there were some, Wyoming had a policy that said certain counties all get their own state representative. So you have two counties in Wyoming, one of which had only 4,000 people, the other one had 8,000. I think those are the numbers as I recall them. And what happened is they said, Wyoming has a longstanding policy of saying every county gets a state rep. So even though that means 4,000 people get one state rep and 8,000 people get another state rep, we're nonetheless going to uphold that policy because it's a legitimate state policy. In the context of that case, as dicta, the court said, we are going to adopt a rule, and again, this is a plurality proposition, that if the deviation from the ideal, in other words, the difference between one person, one vote, is greater than 10%, is what the court said. If it's more than 10%, it is presumptively prima facie unconstitutional, and the state has the burden of coming forward to justify it. If the deviation correspondingly is less than 10% from the ideal of one person, one vote, then in that case, the individuals challenging the district have the burden of coming forward with that. That's the so-called 10% safe harbor rule. It's very disputed. No one really knows how to apply it. And then in a subsequent decision, the court, in a decision by Justice Stevens and Justice Breyer called Cox v. Larios, said specifically that there is no 10% safe harbor. There's no magic number. Justice Scalia dissented and said, well, there has to be. There is a safe harbor. And so going again back to your question, Dean, was I concerned about this as it relates to Justice Scalia? Yes, but in the context of the oral argument, that concern did not seem to be manifest. To the extent there was a concern, it was to the extent that this 10% safe harbor existed. But Justice Scalia himself during oral argument said, but we're not talking about that here. We're not talking about applying that to some abstract issue. We're talking about one person, one vote for reasons that have never been recognized by this court as being legitimate. Again, partisanship and this purported mistaken belief that's necessary to dilute votes to comply with the Voting Rights Act. So given that, after oral argument, I have less concerns about Justice Scalia's view, though, of course, I certainly expect him to still remain consistent with his position. And again, one we share, that federal courts should not be aggressively intervening in states exercising their sovereign redistricting function. That's a long answer. Sorry about that.
No worries. We've got a couple callers with questions on the line now. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's take our first call.
Hi, this is Will Trackman. I'm an attorney at Littler Mendelsohn and then adjunct professor of election law at DU at Denver University. First, a note on the 1964 cases. It's hard to convince my students that those are controversial cases. They see Baker v. Carr as something of part of the canon and see skepticism of those cases, although it was heated at the time, as on par with skepticism of Brown v. Board or other famous cases like that. But my question actually relates to the gerrymander that Colleen Mathis, the so-called independent member of the Redistricting Commission, input into the current Arizona map. Is that done? Is there any ongoing attempt to try to challenge that? I know that, as you mentioned, the courts ruled that they couldn't impeach her. Part of me wants to sue in federal court for a violation of the Republican government guarantee clause or something similar. Or are we just stuck waiting until the next round? And is Colleen Mathis possibly going to be in the next panel as well?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'll answer both. I'll try to be a little more cogent and succinct. First, your point about, the 64 reapportionment cases. Absolutely. I mean, nowadays, those have become the warp and woof of our constitutional reapportionment. One person, one vote. It's become the mantra. We all accept that. I mean, it was, but, as your students would not recall, because they weren't alive then, it was very controversial at the time, particularly Reed, Harlan, and Frankfurter's dissent, and particularly Harlan's dissent, which said, why is the Supreme Court imposing this on states that is a model of one person, one vote, even in state Senate and state representative districts, that is entirely contrary to the federal system where we have disproportionate representation, i.e. Rhode Island gets two senators and California only gets two senators. How can you reconcile that? That whole argument was rejected, of course, but it, again, because we've rightly so accepted this as the law that we live in, we sometimes forget what a controversial proposition it was in 1964. Setting that aside, in terms of the commission, here's what went wrong in this commission, and this came out during our argument. So the excuse me. The Redistricting Commission created what they called a draft map. This was a map that their own expert from Harvard University, they paid $800 an hour to evaluate, said this map complies fully with the Voting Rights Act. It gives you 10 minority ability to elect districts. And we disputed whether they even needed that many. But you have a map. And it has a map with only 4% deviation. And so they had that map. They should have just adopted. But what did they do then? And you mentioned, the chairwoman who was sought to be removed, and the Mathis. What they then did is they said, well, because our expert told us, we could then continue to tinker with it up to 10% deviation. They went and they started moving other pieces of the puzzle around, changing the apportionment of the districts, and they ended up with districts that were 8.8, as close as they could get to 10%, to benefit the Democrats in the final map. So when you look at the one map where they satisfied any legitimate criteria with only a 4% deviation, and they went into the process and then further manipulated and gerrymandered it to try to get a further advantage up to what their consultant told them they could do of 10%, it was clearly not a legitimate effort to achieve any legitimate redistricting goal. And that was a point certainly we brought out. I think the court appreciated that Again, we'll see. If you look at Justice Roberts' decision in the earlier Arizona legislature versus redistricting commission decision, I think Justice Roberts brings that out. So that is certainly a background fact that's undisputed that will color how the court views this. I don't know if I answered your question, but I...
Are we stuck with the map until the next round, and is she going to be on the commission next time around?
She is, unless she resigns or is removed, I mean, she, you know, the commission totally removed from any accountability. So what I expect, you know, who knows what the court will do, of course. What I hope the court does is to invalidate the district or vacate the district court's affirmation of the map and then remand it with directions that they draw a new map, which can be done before the next statewide election.
Got it. Thank you.
Again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, so let's now take another call.
Yes, hello. I have two questions. During the oral arguments, were there any advocates, including yourself, that presented arguments to overturn the lawless 1964 decisions that gave us one man, one vote? And secondly, what federal constitutional principle will be used to decide this case?
Well, to answer your question, the first question is no. Everybody arguing accepts and, in fact, embraces the one person, one vote principle. The question that this case raised on the second question was, how do we implement that and still respect state sovereignty and the necessity of state reapportionment authorities, whether they be a legislature or an independent commission, trying to accommodate factors such as county boundaries, Voting Rights Act compliance, and these other considerations that all go into actually doing the line drawing necessary to get an actual reapportionment accomplished. And that's what the court's struggling with. That's why I think the court granted this, took this case, and I think what they're going to do is look at that feature of both their prior jurisprudence and this case and potentially use this case as a vehicle to announce further guidance that I hope will provide clearer direction to states on when they can deviate from the one person, one vote standard. To your first question, I think there's no one argued one person, one vote was wrong. Everybody accepted it, myself included, certainly. We all agree with the principle. The question that was asked is how do we implement it?
Well, if I have a follow up, if they're trying to respect state sovereignty, and there's nothing in the Constitution that talks about one person, one vote. And of course, you did mention that we have a United States Senate, which obviously is a repudiation of that principle, given the Delaware and California example. Shouldn't the 10th Amendment just sort of say enough of this nonsense and just go with the state sovereignty issue? And secondly, I was wondering if I think Justice Thomas is probably going to be very sensitive to the argument that I'm making. Do you believe that he'll write separately, either in concurrence or dissent, that would say that the case is Baker versus Carr and the other cases that were decided in 1964 were incorrectly decided?
My prediction is that debate, what I call the 1964 debate between, on one hand, Frankfurter, and then on the other hand, the Warren Court has really played out, and it's now become established. I see very little prospect that the court's going to revisit the principle of one person, one vote, but rather, again, they see this case as an opportunity to try to implement that in a practical way, somewhat sensitive to state sovereignty, yet at the same time, many of the members, again, in this case, the liberal members, are suspicious, if not allergic, to charges of partisanship skewing the process from the one person, one vote ideal. So in that sense, some of the liberals are in a little bit of a dilemma because on one hand, they like this notion of an independent redistricting commission removed from partisanship, yet at the same time, they have a commission or asked to defend a commission that engaged in rank partisanship to deviate from that very ideal. So that puts them in a quandary. It'll be interesting to see how they thread that needle. So I think the challenge is more for the liberals on the court this term to answer that question than it is for Scalia or Thomas, though, again, Thomas does tend to concur separately, and it wouldn't surprise me if he did.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
We still have time for additional questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if anyone has another question. Let me take you back to your opening remarks, Mr. Hearn. You were talking about a statement by Justice Scalia where he's sort of musing and wishing that they had gotten the first Arizona case right. And you were talking about him engaging with Justice Breyer on that. And then I thought you began to make some remark about Justice Ginsburg engaging in that discussion and defending the first Arizona case, as she was the author of it. I wonder if you want to say more about that and say more about what Justice Ginsburg might have offered in defense of that first Arizona case.
Right, and that's a good question, Dean, and here's where that goes. So what you have is, and again, I'll use the labels loosely, and they're very loosely used. You have the liberals on the court that are suspicious of partisanship. So that goes all the way back to a case called Davis v. Bandemir in the 70s, where the court allowed for the prospect of what they called judicial gerrymandering claims. Partisan gerrymandering claims. They said such claims were, in fact, justiciable. But they didn't really develop standards. The lower courts were very confused about what it meant, and it put the court in a way of crossing over the line that Frankfurter mentioned of getting into the political thicket, saying, okay, the Democrats in this state had control of the legislature. They were unfair when they reapportioned it, trying to do so in a way that unfairly preserved their entrenched minority as a majority. And the court struggled with that, or in the case of Republicans, it didn't matter which party it was. The court could not come up with some standard by which to evaluate whether a reapportionment was or was not fair. The closest they came up was presented in a case called Veith versus Jubliere that involved Pennsylvania. And the argument made in that case was, well, in Pennsylvania, when we look at the statewide elections for governor, for president, when we look at all those vote totals or other statewide offices, what we find is that Pennsylvania is and I don't recall the numbers, so I'm going to make up some, 55% Democrat, 45% Republican. But Pennsylvania happens to be where the Republicans control the legislature, so they've reapportioned the state, and guess what? The reapportionment allows the Republicans to control 55% of the state legislative seats, and only the Democrats only get 45%. That's unfair. That's their argument. This statewide proportional representation as a measure of whether there is or isn't reapportionment. And there was something, a variant of this in the New York Times two days ago or 3 days before argument, as to how they were arguing we should measure an impermissible gerrymander is when the state individual legislative districts proportionally don't track the statewide vote. The problem with that, as Justice Alito noted during oral argument, is we don't have that system of proportional representation in this country. What we have is a system of representation that is based on individual districts with individual elections by individual voters for individual candidates. And you can't extrapolate this to a proportional representation. So that is what they, what certainly Justice Alito had. So now to your comment about Justice Ginsburg. What Justice Ginsburg said was that she said this was an ineffective gerrymander, so therefore you don't have a problem, right? You don't have a case if the gerrymander did not actually accomplish politically what the Democrat commission wanted it to, which is give the Democrats control of the Arizona legislature. Since they didn't get control of the legislature, therefore, you don't really have a gerrymander. It's like a tree falls in the woods. Does it make a noise? Because, yeah, they unequally apportioned these districts, but they didn't. They were incompetent in doing so, and it didn't actually give the Democrats an advantage. My response to that is, well, that's irrelevant to the point, the fundamental point of this court's one person, one vote rule. If you're diluting votes, even if you dilute them for an incompetent purpose that ineffectively dilutes them and does not actually achieve your partisan end, that doesn't make it any less that those voters living in diluted districts whose votes are diluted have not received the benefit of one person, one vote. So that's a very convoluted answer, I know, but that was the background to my comment.
No, I appreciate that. Let me make a final call for questions. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. Our lines are open. We've still got a couple minutes left here. It does seem, as you're going through your remarks, Thor, that there's two big important blunders here. They got bad legal advice, and they had a bad gerrymandering result. So it's interesting that they come to court making those sorts of arguments. Having said that, it looks like we don't have a final question, but let me give you an opportunity to wrap up and express a final thought.
Thank you again, Dean, and it's great to share with everyone here today, this afternoon. Again, this case is, I think, potentially quite important, depending on how the court handles it. It is a case that involves the three principles or three themes of partisanship, of preclearance, particularly preclearance after Shelby County, and then the burden of proof of those challenging a state legislative redistricting scheme. And I think the court is going to address all three of those. I don't know that we expect a decision before the end of the term in June, but whenever that decision is issued, we think it is one that will dramatically change, or potentially could dramatically change, how states go about the reapportionment process. And it could also, you know, speak to what we all understand to be the limits of the one person, one vote rule.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. My thanks to Mark Thor Hearn for his thoughts here today, and good luck to you as you go forward with this. I hope maybe we can have you back after a decision. This has been a very helpful explanation of the case. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions, and a reminder that our next scheduled teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.